Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Fairfax, a podcast about what it was like to grow up in the Los Angeles area in the early 1960s. It's produced by TJBSRadio.com and is a sort of audio memoir written and recorded by me. I'm Jeff Bushman. Today, I'm a process server, a professional writer, a podcaster, and a few other things. But back in the early 1960s, in L.A., I was what a lot of people were at the time. I was a kid. As I was growing up, I discovered more and more about the area in which we lived. I didn't think it was all that unusual, and it probably wasn't, but there are a few things about it I remember, and people as well, even all these years later. For as long as I can remember, I've had an interest in business and making money. Even when I had no knowledge about what I wanted to do in life, I was interested in how businesses succeeded or failed. When I was 9 or 10 years old, this wasn't necessarily rare or cute, but it was a little weird. Right on Santa Monica Boulevard, there was a barber shop that was fairly large. If I recall, they had 3 or 4 active chairs, and every 2 weeks on Saturday, we'd go to the barber shop. I assume Stu was with us, but I know I went with our father. And I know that for the adult haircut, it was twice the price it was for a kid under 12. Admittedly, this wasn't and isn't all that interesting or important by itself. But after a time, a new barber opened up a little shop of his own. Emmerich was from either Hungary or Poland. I don't remember which. He had 2 chairs in his shop, but for as long as we were there, it was just him barbering. At some stage, I was probably 10, my parents allowed me to go get my haircut on my own. As a side note, I'm astounded that what we accepted as normal in those days would now be considered child abuse or neglect and result in the arrest of our parents. I, for example, traveled all over the city by myself at age 9, 10, and 11 by bus. I never had any negative consequence, but I can imagine how authorities would look at that today. So I started getting my haircuts at Emmerich's little shop. Why he was inclined to ask me, I have no idea, but he did ask me why I thought the bigger shop did so much business and why he was doing so much less. I pointed out to him that he was charging the same price for adults and kids. I remember saying something about a man coming in with 2 young sons and that if they came to him, that would be $7.50, while at the other shop it would be $5, and if they didn't know he'd give them much better haircuts, they were likely to go to the other place. He almost immediately changed his pricing structure and enjoyed an improvement in his business. As a kind of way to honor me, I guess, he asked for a picture, which I gave him, and he put it onto his cash register. When later my cousin walked by the shop, he also lived in the neighborhood, and saw that picture on the cash register, he said to me, "What the hell is the barber doing with your picture?" Before we go any further, let me mention that if you are either in Arizona or have a process-serving need in Arizona, let me recommend to you LighthouseAttorneyService.com. You can find out about process servers there in Arizona or elsewhere for that matter. There's a link to a national organization of servers. But if you do have a need in Arizona, consider LighthouseAttorneyService.com. Another feature of what would now be called the Hood was what I remember as a giant bookstore at Santa Monica Boulevard and Ogden. Ogden was 2 blocks east of Fairfax. The reason that I say I remember it as a giant bookstore is because I'm aware of a tendency we all have to remember something from childhood as much larger than it actually was. Many of us, for example, have gone back to old homes or apartments years after we've moved away, and they seem tiny compared to what we remember them looking like. I know when I went back to the apartment building in Chicago where we had lived before we moved to Fairfax Avenue, it seemed much, much smaller than I remembered. I don't remember the name of the bookstore, but I think it was called Pacific something. That, of course, isn't literally true, but even if it was Pacific, I certainly don't recall the second and or third word in the store's name. Let's hope it was Pacific Books. And oddly, they sold books. That may seem obvious, but if you go into a lot of bookstores modernly, they sell books and magazines, to the extent print magazines still exist, and electronics and games and puzzles and sometimes CDs and DVDs. But Pacific, whatchamacallit, sold books. And they weren't new books, oh no. Pacific, ding-dong, sold used books. And that makes it time... And I'm probably missing someone. I'm sorry, I misstated something. That makes it time to talk a bit about economics. Today, a new paperback book costs about $10. I often buy used books at Goodwill. Paperback's about $2.29 after a recent price increase. New hardcovers run as much as $30 or $35 today, and the used variety can be found for under $4. When I was about 9 or 10 years old, paperbacks were 35 cents and hardcovers were $4.95. I'm pretty sure that just before I started reading paperbacks, they had been increased to that price from 25 cents. I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure that's a 40% increase. Highway robbery. But as said, Pacific, wham bam, sold used books. I honestly don't remember the price, but I think what we now call a mass market paperback could be had for around a dime, and trade paperbacks were probably 20 cents. We didn't have a lot of money, but I spent a fair amount of my allowance at Pacific buying books, and while I certainly don't recall most of the books I bought, some of what I bought were books on hypnosis. Yeah, I was going to be the world's first 10-year-old hypnotist. Although I've never made use of it professionally, I actually did become, about 30 years later, a certified hypnotist. But at Pacific, I bought books on hypnosis, including self-hypnosis, most of which were written by a guy named Melvin Powers. This guy actually did know what he was talking about, and I think he made a fair amount of money, not from selling books in the used bookstore, but from his new book sales. He even created a publishing company to self-publish his books. It was called Wilshire Books, named for a major and somewhat classy street that was in L.A., Wilshire Boulevard. Old Mel taught me how to make my hand numb using my mind so I could put it down on a table and let my classmates hit my hand and I wouldn't feel any pain. That actually worked, but it didn't have too much practical application so far as I could see then. Later, in junior high school, I would demonstrate this ability for my friends, and it attracted some attention, but for some reason, none of it was from girls. But I digress. I've used some of these techniques to relax a bit through dental work. Of course, don't hold back with Novocaine. And to calm myself down on a bumpy plane ride. In those days, though, after reading some of those books, I practiced hypnosis on my friends, Steve and Mike, who were more than willing to be subjects. On one occasion, they came over to our apartment, and one of Melvin Powers' tricks was to get someone into a hypnotic state and then put something strong smelling under their nose while their eyes were closed and tell them it was some other smell. Steve was lying down on the couch and appeared to be under. The only strong smelling substance in the apartment that I could think of was a jar of instant coffee. I put the coffee jar under his nose and told him it was a very sweet-smelling French perfume. What a bunch of preteens knew about French perfume was probably slightly less than nothing, but Steve was a good sport, and on my instructions, he took a deep sniff. Unfortunately, that made him sneeze, and the instant coffee inside the jar was ruined, and the powder was all over his face and on his shirt. As said, he was a good sport about it, and we all had a decent laugh, but it set my career in hypnosis back several notches. But getting back to Pacific, it was an absolute paradise for a little geek like me. I still enjoy trips to the library on my own and with Dad, but owning books always seemed, and still does, like a special treat that on one level makes a person feel rich. People who are truly poor, of course, can't afford to buy books, but if you can buy books and take as long as you want to read them and maybe give them away when you're done with them. That seems like a special kind of wealth, even now. Though, like now, I enjoyed reading mystery novels, I also enjoyed what might be called humor books. In those days, they still had such things. We do now, but they're much fewer. In those days, we had used books from Robert Benchley and S.J. Perlman and H. Allen Smith and James Thurber, among others. Today, we have David Sedaris. In between, there were Woody Allen and Steve Martin, and I'm probably forgetting someone. If you don't know those older authors, Robert Benchley wrote humorous essays and was also an actor in the 30s and 40s, often inserted into a film for comic relief. He was a funny man generally and was also the uncle of an author you may recall, Peter Benchley. He was the author of Jaws. Perlman, besides his books, also wrote a few of the Marx Brothers movies, and James Thurber, besides writing funny magazine pieces, was also better known as a cartoonist. And Pacific was my place to walk around and smell books and read introductions and buy books, buy a couple of books every week or two. What a blast. Another semi-regular stop for me was at the Stamp Ladies. I don't really know if the tendency still exists among kids of a certain age, but it did when we were 9, 10, and maybe 11, to collect coins. In those days, we'd buy blue folders that had slots in them for specifically dated coins from different mints, and you'd find the coins, presumably from regular pocket change, pardon me, and you'd fill the books. So one would have, for example, a book of Roosevelt dimes from 1946 to 1961, and there would be three slots for each year because they were produced by three different mints, and which one the dime was minted at was reflected in a mark on the dime. So you weren't just looking for a 1947 10-cent piece. You were looking for the 1947 dime that was produced at each of the three mints, Denver, Philadelphia, and San Francisco. It was the same deal with each of the other coin denominations. We were especially eager when I was a kid to get Mercury dimes, as they had stopped making them after 1945 when the Roosevelt dimes replaced them, and they were becoming rare in change transactions, but you could still get them. Now, if you ever see a Mercury dime, it's a very rare find. While I did collect coins for a while, I became smitten by stamp collecting. I will confess that collecting stamps taught me a good deal about the world. If I said certain words to you that I learned from collecting stamps, most Americans wouldn't know what I was talking about. Any idea what Österreich means? While I can't necessarily pronounce that word properly, I know it's what Austrians call their own country. Sverige is Sweden to us, and Suomi is what the Finns call what we call Finland. And that, of course, is just the start. In what I think was probably 1961, I discovered that just down Santa Monica Boulevard, in walking or bike riding distance, was a lady who lived behind her storefront. I don't even know if she had a name of a company in the window, but it said something clever like stamps, and had a few foreign stamps and a stamp album showing. If I ever knew her name, I certainly don't recall it now. And I always think of her as the stamp lady. On one level, she reminded me of my maternal grandmother because around both of them, I could smell their ice blue secret deodorant. But unlike my grandmother, the stamp lady really knew about stamps. I was mostly interested in American stamps that were old, but she also got me interested in some foreign stamps. One of the series I remember collecting was from the country of Monaco. For those who don't know, Monaco is a really small country that has two principal industries. One is gambling in Monte Carlo, which is within Monaco, and the other one is, or was, producing stamps for collectors. The series I collected was that which was celebrating the wedding of Prince Rainier, who, though a prince and not a king, was the ruler of the country, and the Meghan Markle of her day, American actress Grace Kelly. I also collected a lot of stamps from the United Kingdom and countries of the British Commonwealth. I think I did that because they were all in English and I could read English. Though I haven't spent time with my collection in a long time, I'm still a stamp collector. Unfortunately, I don't any longer have the collection I started and maintained with the help of the stamp lady. It was lost in one of my residential moves that I made as an adult. But for as long as I had it, it provided an enormous amount of pleasure, of course. That's the end of this episode of Fairfax. You can get more episodes at tjbsradio.com, along with other podcasts that we think you'll like. In the meantime, until next time, thanks very much for listening, and please, 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 be kind to each other. Good night.